Tonight we're talking about a man. We're also talking about a book, the book of Job. We're talking about a problem, and a problem that comes into the bosom of the family probably more often than any other. The difficulties of life, the deaths, the economic depressions, the social calamities, the problems of living together as a family. And I believe that that was what the book of Job was written to explain to us. And we'll be taking this up as a character study. We'll be taking this up as a study chapter by chapter, a chapter analysis, and then putting the chapters together so that they all fit and we understand the book as a unit. And in your own chapter analyses, as you study through the Bible, make sure you see how one chapter fits into the next and so on throughout the entire book. The first part that I'd like to suggest we read together here out of the first chapter beginning in verse 1. Job 1:1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was perfect and upright, and one that feared God and eschewed evil. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance also was 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she-asses and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the east. And his sons went and feasted in their houses every one his day, and sent and called for their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning, and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned, and cursed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. Let's you tell me what you find about this man Job. In this first verse, for example, one of the first things you find here.
Godly.
He was a godly man. Anything else?
He hated evil.
He what?
He hated evil.
He hated evil. That's connected with being godly, but it's an important part of being godly. What's another one?
Perfect.
He was perfect. Well, let's see what that word means. Anything else? Anybody see where he lived? Where was? We don't know where Uz was. But the important thing that we're getting at here is simply this, that this man Job lived. Just because we don't know where he lived doesn't detract from the fact that he lived. Just as surely as you are living, and he felt pain, and he, and this is not fiction, it's written in the form of a drama, and I think you'll see the various themes as we go along here. But nevertheless, this man Job is no fictitious character. God said that he lived. He lived in the land of Uz. His name was Job. He was perfect and upright. The word perfect, as it's used here in Hebrew, is the word tamim. He is an all-round good man. Doesn't mean he was perfect in the way that Jesus Christ was perfect, having never once sinned. Means that he was good whether anyone was there to see him being good or not. I think there's one illustration of that that fits better than anything else. This was the man who went around and opened the door of the car for his wife, whether there was anyone there to see him or not. Hear me? Good all the way around. Good all the time. Good whether anyone was there to see him or not. This was the word tamim, as it means perfect there, perfect and upright. He feared God and eschewed evil. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He was a family man. There was life connected there. His substance, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses, a very great household. You men who can remember numbers, remember those figures. Because before the end of the book, we'll have to account for those figures. Remember them. They aren't put in there just to amuse you. They're important, very important. We'll come back to them. And they also indicate that he was a very wealthy man, the greatest of all the men of the East, probably a king. Now, the East has produced some very wealthy men. This says that he was the greatest of that day, the greatest of all the kings, the multimillionaires of that day in the East. No mean man. economically, politically, and in every other sense of the word. And let's go on to verse 4 to see if we can find anything else about this man. God is interested in introducing us thoroughly to this man. And when you read a character study in God's book, pay attention to these descriptions. They're God. They're important. And his sons went and feasted in their houses every one his day, and sent and called for their three sisters to eat and to drink with them. Anything unusual about that? Anything unusual about that? Brothers and sisters get along? Well, it is more unusual then than now. There's one of the old philosophers writing about that time. He said there are three levels of life. One is man at the top. At the bottom is the dumb brute. Someplace in between comes woman. Not down there, no, but certainly not up here either. It was Jesus Christ that made a difference, insofar as you ladies are concerned, really. And yet, in this man's household, he had flown in the very teeth of all the social customs of that day. And these brothers invited their sisters to eat and to drink with them, on a level with them. It's hard to buck social custom in the world today, but these brothers did it, apparently. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them. Rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all, for Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their heart. Thus did Job continually. Job here proves that he's more than just the oldest male member of the household. He is a spiritual father for his children. It says that he sanctified them, he offered up burnt offerings, he prayed for them, lest his sons have cursed God. One of my friends was trying to witness to a lady friend of hers not long ago in Indianapolis, and the lady friend stopped her and then turned and swore at God directly. Cursed God in this sense of the word. This is not what's meant here. The word cursed God means just say goodbye, God. This is the thing Job's concerned lest his sons would do. Say, well, goodbye, God. I just don't have time enough for you. I'm so busy getting along in life. Goodbye, God. This is what the word, say farewell to God, curse God, is the literal meaning of the Hebrew word there. Goodbye, God. And Job's concerned lest his sons come to this point. And so he prays for them daily on this score. And I forgot to mention in the fourth verse up there that his sons went and feasted in the house of everyone his day. It's a nice little point there, but we went to a family reunion in Bob's house one day, and Jim's house another day, and Tom's house another day, and we passed around. We took turns in it. It was a family filled with love. It was a family filled with light. It was a family filled with wealth. It was a family filled with respect. God said, this man Job is good and upright. Perfect. Not in the sense that Christ was, but he's an all-around good man. In God's eyes, I don't want to argue with God on this subject, this is his estimate of this man Job. End of scene one. Let's go on to scene two. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. And the Lord said unto Satan, whence comest thou? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, I'm going to and fro in the earth and walking up and down in it. And the Lord said unto Satan, Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, doth Job fear God for naught? Hast not thou made an hedge about him and about his house and about all that he hath on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hand, and his substance is increased in the land. But put forth thine hand now and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, behold, all that he hath is in thy hand, in thy power. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand. So Satan shot forth from the presence of the Lord. Now, you tell me where scene one took place. Where was scene one located? On it. You tell me where scene two took place. There was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Where did the sons of God come to present themselves before the Lord? This sounds to me very much as though it's heaven. There's only one destroying thing about it, disconcerting, and that is that Satan came also among them. I hate to think of him being up there. I've had enough trouble with him down here. And yet, you know, there's another angle to this thing. I'd rather see him there than down here. If he has to be someplace, I'd like to see him there. But do you know there's not one word in the Bible about Satan's being in hell? We begin thinking of his being in hell, and he loves us. He don't wish to stand down there. Make sure. And here we have the sea. I believe this is in heaven. And Satan came also among them. This is a count-off. The sons of God came to present themselves to the Lord. And Mr. Satan came also to account. And God speaks first. You notice that? And the Lord said to Satan, on board ship when I went in to see the captain, I didn't speak first. He did. And I'm glad to see God in control of the situation. This is encouraging to me insofar as Satan's concerned. This is an important factor, and you'll see more of this before the evening's over in this relationship here. God said, Satan, sound off. Where you been and what have you been doing? Report. And Satan said in a kind of a sneer, I've been shooting to and fro in the earth and walking up and down in it. And the Hebrew wording here is the same that we have for lightning in other parts of the Bible. He strikes here and here and here and here. And this is the way Satan is describing how he works. I like to listen to this conversation between God and Satan. It cues me in a little bit. This is the way he works on me. He never lands twice the same place the same way. Satan says, I've been shooting to and fro on the earth and walking up and down in it. And then the Lord said unto Satan, Satan, have you seen Job with all your shooting to and fro on the earth? Hast thou seen my servant Job? He's a good man. Satan. Good man, have you seen?
Goading him.
It was not Satan who came to God and said, now let me find a good man and I'll get after him. But it was God who called Satan's attention to Job. He says, now Satan is a good man with all your shooting to and fro on the earth. Have you seen him? Have you overlooked him? What's the matter? And he's still a perfect and upright man, and he fears me, and he fears evil. And then Satan sneers back, and he says, doth Job fear God for naught? Hast not thou made an hedge about him, and about his house, and about all that he hath on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hand, and his substance is increased in the land. But God, put forth thine hand now, and touch all that he hath, and he'll curse thee to thy face. He'll say, goodbye, God. Now, that's a pretty intelligent sneer, isn't it? You see what Satan is charging God with there in Job 2? He says, sure, he's a good man, God, but he's a good man because he's prosperous. You take away some of that prosperity, and he'll say, goodbye, God. Tell me, men and women, what if God were to take away your prosperity tonight? Now, are you pious? And I'm using that word not in the bad sense, but in the good sense. And it needs to be used in the good sense, the right sense. Are you pious because of your prosperity? How long would you remain true to God if he took away everything that you have? Isn't that a family problem? And that's why this book is written. And that's Satan's stuff. He says, God, you take away that man's prosperity and he'll curse you to your face. He'll say, goodbye, God. I don't have time enough for you from here on. I'm done with you. And so God said to Satan, all right, behold, Satan, all that he hath is in thy power. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand. All that he hath is in thy power. And here again, you're going to see this happen several times this evening. And every time I see this, it reminds me of that story that Mark Twain told of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. I've forgotten which one it was. But the boys were all squared off to fight. I think it was Huck Finn. And he took his bare toe and he drew a line in the dust. And he said to the other boy, all right, step across that line. And it seems to me this is what God is saying to Satan.
All right, Satan, you can go so far, but no farther, insofar as your troubling is my man is concerned. You can take away all that he hath, only upon himself put not forth thine hand. Do these things get out from under God? When tragedy hits a family, only upon himself put not forth thine hand. Now, I like to see God controlling Satan that way. I like to see that. And that's basic theology. And this keeps on happening. Satan hasn't changed, and neither has God. This keeps on happening in the world today. All right, let's go on to scene 3. Verse 13 in chapter 1. And there was a day when his sons and daughters, Job's sons and daughters, were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And there came a messenger unto Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them away. And they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, the fire of God is fallen from heaven and hath burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, the Chaldeans made out three bands and fell upon the camels and have carried them away, yea, and slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. And while he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in the eldest brother's house. And behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they were dead. And I only am escaped alone to tell thee. And then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped and said, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave. The Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And in all this Job sinned not, and charged God seriously. Where does this thing take place? Back down on earth again. I think we can see this old oriental monarch, stately, in all his majesty and dignity, and he's sitting out here under his palm tree in front of his tent, and the flocks and herds as far as he can see across the horizon of his, and he knows that beyond the horizon on the other, beyond those ranches are the ranches of his sons, as far as he can see, belongs to him, as his son. They're his. And he's content, and he's happy and satisfied. And there's a family reunion over at Bob's house this day. I don't know why Job wasn't at it too, but he wasn't. Maybe he was too old. The kids were enjoying themselves, and he stayed home on this particular day. But anyhow, as he's sitting there, he sees this servant come over the horizon up the path. And he thinks there must be something wrong. The servant's running. He didn't run in the middle of the day, and that something is wrong. And he gets to him, and he says, the Sabaeans, the oxen were plowing, the asses, and the Sabaeans and took them away. And they slew all the servants, and I'm the only one that got away. And while he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, the fire of God fell down from heaven, burned up all the sheep and the servants, and I'm the only one that got away. And while he was yet speaking, the Chaldeans made out three bands, another one came in and told him about how all the camels had been taken. And old Job's mathematical mind had been picking these things off just like this as a businessman that he was, and he realized that from a man of tremendous wealth, he had suddenly been reduced to a position of terrific poverty. These were the stocks and bonds of that day. This is the bank account of that day. This is the Great Depression. And it had hit him all at once. And Job only had one other possession. It was really close to him and dear to his heart. I think his heart went a little bit cold as he saw that other servant come running over the horizon. And that man reached him and he said, you know, your sons and daughters were over here 5 times today. And there was a great wind came from out of the water and smoked the four corners of that house, and they were all dead. You think that's going to happen in the world today? I know a lady in Indianapolis who was suffering from cancer, and she knew she had only a short time to live. And she insisted that her husband should take their young children on a trip to Florida for the Christmas vacation.
and that she would remain at home. She was no longer able to travel. And they flew, and on the way their plane crashed, and they had to take that message back to her the next morning. But they had all gone on ahead of her, and she was the last one in their family. And families die to death. And old Job is among the greatest of all specimens of human grief. You know, it requires a person, a human being, to understand grief. You don't find a dog or an animal any dumb bleak, plumbing the depths of grief the way a human being does. And Job is among the greatest specimens, and we see him here as he arises and rends his mantle and shaves his head, and he falls down upon the ground and he worships his creator. And he says, God, if you hadn't given me so much in the first place, I couldn't have lost so much. Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. And I think he must have said it through tense teeth, blessed be the name of the Lord. But he said it. In all that he sinned not, has tried God truly. He still didn't say, well, goodbye, God. You see, we say, well, of course, it's just Satan taking those things away. But Job didn't know that any more than you and I know what's going to happen to us tonight on our way home before we go to church. Job hadn't heard the conversation that went on between God and Satan. It's as though there were a stage wall here, and God and Satan were conversing up here, and Job was down here. And Satan gets his dismissal from God, and he wastes no time. He races down here, and he hits Job at every angle, or almost every angle. Let's go on to see what happens in the next scene, chapter 2, verse 1. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Here's this. Heaven again. All sounds exactly the same way that it did before. What's the reason your study of the Word of God? What's to see where things are taking place, as well as what's happening? The day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. Mr. Satan reporting to duty again to it. And the Lord said unto Satan, Satan, sound off. Give an account of yourself. From whence comest thou? And Satan said the same thing he said before. From going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down. Shooting to and fro and walking down, up and down. And the Lord said unto Satan, Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that feareth God and that feareth evil? And still he holdeth fast his integrity, although thou movedest me against him to destroy him without a doubt. He still stands there. You said that if I took away his prosperity, he'd lose his true power. He didn't do it. Now what do you think of it? He's done the worst he can do. Then Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. All that a man hath will he give for his life. But put forth thine hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, all right, Satan, behold, he is in thine hand, but listen, you spare his life. And you get the significance of Satan's sneer and his taunt here again. Satan is saying this. Job is a basically selfish person. Even his family doesn't amount that much to it. There are some people, Satan's saying, that you have to get right down to the nerve endings where they hurt themselves. And until you do, it's not going to make any difference to them. Even their family, they don't care that much about it. And so God said to Satan, all right, Satan, you go ahead and test him, because I don't want any loophole in this test. I don't want any loophole at all. See, Satan was charged with man was so basic, finally false. And God said, all right. But listen, Satan, you're not going to be allowed to take this life. And Satan would like to have taken Job's life if he had dared. Because he's going to find out he's going to lose his son. And he'd love to have taken his life. And then it would have seemed as though God had delivered Job over into the hands of Satan. But it here again. We have God drawing a thin line this time and saying, Satan, you can come just to that point on May 5th. The mother whose young baby daughter had been killed by a drunken driver who was so profane and blasphemous in his inconsiderateness of the entire situation. And that mother said to me, did that get out from under the control of God? Is this a pure work of Satan taking that life? And I was glad to remember this. And I was able to say, no. No soul goes unbidden into the presence of God. These things do not get out from under his control. He controls that. Satan does not take lives without God's control of the situation. And again, Satan wastes not an instant of time, not one instant of time in chapter 7. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils and the sole of his foot under his crown. He took him a potsherd to shake himself withal and he sat down among the ashes. Now in your own study of the Word of God, I've commented on this several times. Watch where things are taking place. Watch where these conversations lead. The first scene there in the first six verses has to do with the scene on earth. Job as he appears on earth. Then verses 6 through 12 has to do with the scene in heaven. Satan and God talking together there in heaven. And then verses 13 through 22 back down on earth again. And then beginning in chapter 2, we're back up in heaven again. From verse 7 of chapter 2 on through to the end of the book, we stick down here on earth. We don't keep shooting back and forth. We're down here on earth. And Satan, first of all, as he comes back down to hit Job this time, hits him with these sore boils. It's an interesting word for boil that's used there in the Hebrew. It means something more than boil. I wish some medical man someday would take up that word and study it. There are some things that cause me to believe it's leprosy. That's what cracks into the bone and leaves the body disfigured and for which there is no healing. One of the things that causes me to think it's something more than just the ordinary boil as we have it is the way in which Job treated it. He had a potsherd, a piece of broken pottery, and he scraped it. He kept scraping it from time to time. The other thing that causes me to think it was more than that is that he was isolated to an ash heap. He was quarantined. This was the position for the Oriental of total quarantine. No cure for this man. And of course, this is true of the leper colony. Now I want you ladies to tell me what kind of woman Job's wife was. We'll call her Molly. And we have her described to you in the very next verse. I don't want any man to say anything, but I want some lady to tell me what kind of woman Molly was. Then said Molly unto Job, dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die. But Job said to her, thou speakest as one of the foolish women speak, Molly. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? And in all this did not Job sin with his lips. And then everybody pick one. What kind of woman was she? Every time you see a husband-wife relationship in here, you ladies, I studied and seen applied scripture every once in a while to ladies who always wanted to see what her husband was supposed to do and do. And I kept saying, but what does the wife do? And there are some ladies who always read the Bible to see what the husband is supposed to do. Or be. Tell me what this wife was like. She was selfish. Anybody else have another idea? She didn't love the Lord? You can. You're being pretty hard on her. Anybody else have an idea? It doesn't sound like she did. All right. All right. I think she loved her husband, perhaps putting him before the Lord. You're being and a little kinder to us. All right. This is an important point here. Margie's not here. This has something to do with my analysis for us. But I think that this lady was a Jewel, not a Jezebel. One of the reasons for saying that is that there are 42 chapters in the book. And this is the only time she spoke. But there's some other things that causes me to think it, too. You see, she did encourage and advise her husband to say the very thing that Satan had said that he would say. Why don't you say, goodbye, God? I just don't have time for him anymore. She counseled her husband, however, in distraction. And she was in despair. If she hadn't loved him so much, it wouldn't have been so hard for her. But you see, her faith rested on two pillars. One was God's uprightness, and the other was her husband's integrity. And she had been with her husband, and she knew that he had not done anything to cause this kind of tragedy to come into his life. The only thing left to doubt was God's righteousness or justice. And so she did. And she said, why don't you curse God? Why don't you say goodbye, God? And God, she couldn't stand to see her husband suffer that way. And she counseled him in distraction because she loved him too much at that point. And he turns to her and he says, well, Molly, suppose I do curse God and then don't die, I'd be more miserable than I was before. If I curse God and do die, I'll go into the very presence of the God that I've said farewell to. And I submit to you that there comes that time in the fortuitous concourse of events in every family when one of the two says, oh, why don't we give up and quit trying? And I believe that's why God put us down here in terms of teams, a husband and a godly wife. One of the two, in this case it happened to be Joseph, one of the two had to say, no, you're not really yourself today. Today you're speaking with one of the foolish ones. And it was an unusual thing for Molly to speak that way. But she did it because she loved her husband to that extent. And she couldn't stand with it. She wasn't a gold digger. She didn't leave him when he lost all that he had. She stuck with him on that issue. She was right there beside him. And you see, it had been Satan's dilemma in terms of the overall picture to have taken her life along with the lives of the children. And maybe that would have been the straw that would have broken the camel's back. But let's spare her life so that when his resistance is low, then we can come to him. And if Job hadn't loved his wife, it really wouldn't have been much of a temptation to him. But he had loved her and he had learned to respect her opinion. A woman's a good business mind, you know. And all the years long, Job had learned to respect his wife's opinion. Here comes his camel driver up there, and he has a load of camels, and Job turns around and he's trying to sell him to a 2-year-old, and Molly says, don't buy it. She hadn't seen anything. He says, Job says, I'm going to buy it. And she says, don't do it. He says, well, it's a fine camel, and Molly hadn't seen the camel, but she's just been looking at the driver. And she says, don't do it. And Job says, I'm going to do it anyway. And so he goes in and buys it. The next morning, he wakens up and finds the camel way back. Well, I don't know you find the way back camel, but whatever. whatever could be wrong with the camel is wrong with the camel. And so all through the years, he had learned to trust her wisdom and advice. And now because he loved her and learned to trust her, it becomes a terrific temptation to her. And she says that at this particular point. But his love is first of all for his Lord. And his first loyalty, even above that of his wife, is to his Lord. And so he says, Mama, we're going to accept all this good from the hand of God all down through these years, and then not accept this little bit of bad? No. We're going to accept this God.
no matter what it costs, you're going to stick with God.
And that's the experience you'll face. There'll be a dozen people in here before you die that'll face that experience in life. In one way or another. It's a family book. This is God's working out the family tragedy and showing us how they work in terms of Satan's use of a wife. But she was a good woman. She was a good woman, I believe. No godly man ever lived with an ungodly woman on earth in contentment and peace and happiness and joy as we find Job doing here. Knowing that that one would not be with him in God's presence for eternity and still happy? No. No, it cannot be. A godly man lives in happiness with a godly woman. These two lived in happiness, and therefore I believe that she was a godly woman. Don't look down at her. Don't look down at her, but understand what caused her to do what she did. And be prepared for it when it comes your own way. But that wasn't the end of it. Satan is still working through many different sources, through other people now, not directly, but through other people. Now when Job's, in verse 11 of chapter 2, now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came every one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamathite, for they had made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, they lifted up their voice and wept. They rent every one his mantle, sprinkled dust upon their heads toward heaven. So they sat down upon the ground 7 days and seven nights, and none spake a word, for they saw that his grief was very great. These were three friends, three close friends. And from all that we can see, they were great men of the East. They were some of the greatest, probably three other kings from the East. And it wasn't that they just happened to be riding by one day and heard that Job was sick either. These three kings with kingdoms and empires of their own found that their old friend over here was sick, and they made an appointment to come to see him. It wouldn't have been a case of getting in either. They'd have had to ride across that desert on camels. And they came to comfort him. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Remember the order of those. It's important. And they lifted up their eyes, and they didn't even recognize him when they first saw him. He was so disfigured by this disease, whatever it was. Sickness. The sickness was so intense. Yeah, Satan works through sickness. He weakens the body. The spirit's involved here some way or other. And they didn't even recognize him because he was so sick. They lifted up their voices and wept, rent everyone his mantle, sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven, sat down upon the ground 7 days and seven nights. This is what they did for a week, for a person who was dead. He was so close to death that they were mourning his death at that point. That is, he looked so close to death. This is how bad it was. But he wasn't dead. No, sir. He has a lot of life there. After this, in chapter 3, Job... After this, opened Job his mouth and cursed his day. And Job spake and said, let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said there is a man child conceived. Let that day be darkness. Let not God regard it from above, neither let the light shine upon it. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it. Let a cloud dwell upon it. Let darkness of the day terrify it. God says, Job says, I wish I could reach right up to the calendar and just jerk the 7th of February right out. If there'd never been any 7th of February, I wouldn't have been born on that date. And I'd like to jerk that date right out of the calendar. I wish I'd never been born. There's still some life in this old man. And he expresses that life. But he's miserable in this life. There's a lot of talk about Job's patience. I don't like that. There's some indication here that Job was pretty impatient. And we'll see a little more about it a little bit later. Endurance? Yes. And the New Testament indicates endurance. And he stood. But there was a note of impatience here about that standing. It wasn't just the same kind of standing that just sort of hoops over and forgets everything and goes numb. There was real life. Job tingled with life. Not so much patience, there's endurance. Don't forget that in your evaluation of this character. And Job talks down through here, all through the third chapter, and he regrets his birth, and he regrets the fact that he's even had to live. This is how much he's hurting, and how deep he's pained. And then in chapter 4, Eliphaz the Temanite answers. Now these three men, remember, why had they come? What was their purpose in coming to see Job? They came to comfort him. Don't forget that. That's important. They came to comfort their buddy who was sick. And Eliphaz the Temanite answered, and he said, here's his speech. If we essay to commune with thee, wilt thou be grieved? But who can withhold himself from speaking? Behold, Job, days have come and gone, when thou hast instructed many, and the days were when thou hast strengthened the weak hand. Thy words, Job, in years gone by, have upholden him that was falling, and thou hast strengthened the feeble knees in your day. But now it is come upon thee, and thou faintest. It toucheth thee, and thou art troubled. Is not this thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope, the uprightness of thy ways? Remember, I pray thee, whoever perished being innocent? Or where were the righteous cut off? Even as I have seen. Now this is the old man, and when you listen to Eliphaz, he's the oldest. This is Oriental custom, the oldest spoke first. You can fairly see him stroking that long white beard. Even as I have seen in all my years of experience, even as I have seen, they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same. Huh? What? They that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same. What kind of comfort is that? I've seen some people go into a hospital room and bring that kind of comfort, I think. Miserable comforters, though. Here was the point. The Oriental had an idea of God's justice, and it said this, that if you saw a man suffering, it was because he had sinned. If you saw a man sin, he was going to suffer. And sin and suffering were one in their thinking. The two were inseparable. They were one and the same. And if you analyze Eliphaz's whole speech down through there from beginning to end, you'll find it has one message. And that one message is this. Job, you must have sinned because you're suffering. You're suffering, you must have sinned. There's no other way about it. That's it. You suffer, you sin. You sin, you suffer. That's the long and short of it. He sort of dusts his hands off this way as an old man. Well, chapter 6. I wonder how Job responds to this. I wish we could take these up in more detail. I'll have to give you my analysis of these speeches. But watch this in your own study of the Word of God. This is the way God divides the chapters up. And when you're doing a chapter study in any book of the Bible, don't just finish with one chapter and then go to the next and forget the relationship between them. But watch to see how your chapters fit together. And in chapter 6, Job answers Eliphaz. Job answered and he said, oh, that my grief were thoroughly weighed and my calamity laid in the balances together. For now it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words are swallowed up. The arrows of the Almighty are within me. The poison whereof drinketh up my spirit. The terrors of God do set themselves in array against me. Doth the wild ass bray when he hath grass? Loweth the ox over his fodder? Eliphaz, don't you suppose I know this principle that you've been explaining to me called God's justice? That if a man sins, suffers, it means he must have been sinning? Don't you think I know that? And yet you see me sitting here objecting? Why, even a wild ass doesn't bray if he has something to eat. You hear me objecting, you hear me braying, and it means there must be something more to it than that. You haven't even listened to my words. I know I haven't done the kind of thing that could cause this kind of tragedy. There must be some other explanation for it. Of course, you and I know that there's another explanation for it, because God said back there at the beginning that this man, Job, was a perfect and an upright man, and we heard the conversation between God and Satan. And we know that God thinks of Job as being a good man and that Satan's trying it.
But Eliphaz doesn't know that. All Eliphaz knows is that Job is suffering, and therefore he must have sinned. And he keeps driving home at this, and Satan objects. Or Job objects, I mean. He responds, he reacts to it. Job speaks for two whole chapters there. Then we go over to chapter 8, and it's Bildad's turn this time. Then answered Bildad the Shuhite. And Bildad said, Job, that's a long speech that Job has, and it's pretty fiery in places. And Bildad comes right back at him. In all his speech, Job says, but I didn't do the kind of thing that could cause this kind of suffering. Bildad the Shuhite said, how long wilt thou speak these things? How long shall the words of thy mouth be like a strong wind? Job, you're full of hot air. Clear comfort, huh? And then in verse 8, we see who this Bildad was. He was a historian, actually. He says in verse 8, for inquire, I pray thee, of the former age, and prepare thyself to search of their fathers. He says, in my study of history, that was his claim to fame and to be able to advise Job. He says, I've studied history. I know what happened in the past. Because I know what happened in the past, therefore I know what's going to happen in the future. I have a formula here, and I fit the current events into that formula, and I can predict what's going to happen and what's happened to you. Now, we'll see what Job responds to this over here. Job goes on over in chapter 11. In chapter 9, Job answered and said, I know it is so of a truth, but how should a man be just with God? If he will contend with him, he cannot answer him one of a thousand. Bildad's argument is the very same as the argument of Eliphaz. Job, you're suffering. You must have sinned. What sin did you do? They that plow iniquity and sow wickedness are going to reap the same thing. You plow your wild oats, you're going to sow it. You're getting just what you deserve. That's Bildad's whole argument. And Job reacts to it the same way he had before with Eliphaz, except he's getting more tired. Look in chapter 10, the first verses. Job says, my soul is weary of my life. I will leave my complaint upon myself. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Show me wherefore thou contendest with me. Is it good unto thee that thou shouldst oppress? Job still insists upon taking his argument directly to God. We'll see if he continues this. But we need to go on to chapter 11 to see what Zophar's comfort is. Then Zophar the Naamathite. Now, he was the youngest man. You see, in Oriental custom, the oldest spoke first. And every indication we have was that this man, Eliphaz, was the oldest, even as I have seen. And then comes Bildad, the historian. And now comes the young upstart, Zophar. And remember, Job is an old man, too. Much older than Zophar. Zophar comes on the basis of his ability to think. He had a bright new PhD or RFD or something or other right out of the mail order catalog, and he could just think. This was his ability. And he goes on, he says here in chapter 11, then answered Zophar the Naamathite, and he said, should not the multitude of words be answered, Job? Should not a man full of such talk be justified? Should thy lies make men hold their peace? And when thou mockest, shall no man make thee ashamed? For thou hast said, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in thine eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against thee, and that he would show thee the secrets of wisdom, that they are double to that which is. Know therefore, Job, that God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserveth. And then he goes on down there to impart to Job the secrets of God's wisdom. I'm always wary of the man who says, well, now I'll speak for God. I'd rather he'd show me the passage in Scripture and ask if God could speak to me through that. I'm always wary of the man who speaks this way. And I think God put this example in here of that which we're not to do insofar as counseling with other people is concerned. Well, this was by far the most severe of all. And then let's see how Job responds to this one. Remember, he's almost dead. They thought he was. They were sitting there for his wake, for his funeral. But he's not quite. Look in chapter 12. And Job answered, and he said, "No doubt, but ye are the people, and wisdom shall die with you. But I have understanding as well as you. I am not inferior to you. Yea, who knoweth not such things as these? I am one as mocked of his neighbor, who calleth upon God, and he answereth him. The just and upright man is laughed to scorn." Now that's pretty severe conversation between men who are such friends as these. And yet there's something that I admire about this old man. He's almost dead, but he says, "I desire to reason with God on this subject. And I'm not going to submit my case to you men. I'm not convinced that you're right." He's alone. And of course, we see the picture as Satan is lining up all these influences. All these physical influences are being brought to bear upon him socially, economically, physically, and now in terms of his friends and best confidants, his wife, and now these three close bosom friends of his, and all of them are standing, and they don't know they're being used by Satan. They really don't know that. But this one old man is having to stand there, and I'm not surprised that he comes back sometimes pretty fiery. I'm really not. It's about his last gasp and his last defense, but I like the way he stands there. I like the way he stands there. And this is the first round, but it's not the last round. Job answers Zophar, and then they begin on him again. Look in the 15th chapter. Eliphaz speaks to him. He doesn't say a thing new. He comes back with the same argument a thousand different ways. "Job, you're suffering. You must have sinned. Now what'd you do?" Tries to get him to confess something. And Job answers him in chapter 16. Look how Job answers. Chapter 16, verse 1. "Then Job answered, and he said, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are ye all. Shall vain words have an end?" And Bildad goes after him again in chapter 18. He's equally severe. He becomes more severe. "How long will it be ere ye make an end of words? Mark, and afterwards we shall speak. We're counted as beasts," and so forth. Chapter 19. Chapter 19. Everybody turn to chapter 19. This is a high point in the book. Job has been worked over and over and over and over again by these three men. Don't know how many times. "Then Job answered, and he said, How long will you vex my soul and break me in pieces with words? These 10 times have you reproached me, and you're not ashamed that you make yourselves strange to me. Be it indeed that I've erred, mine error remaineth with myself. If indeed you will magnify yourselves against me and plead against me my reproach, then know now that God is the one that's overthrown me. God hath compassed me with his net. Behold, I cry out of wrong. I'm not heard. I cry aloud, but there's no judgment. He hath fenced up my way that I cannot pass, and he hath set my darkness in my paths. He hath stripped me of my glory. He's taken the crown from my head. He's destroyed me on every side, and I'm gone, and mine hope hath he removed like a tree. He hath kindled his wrath against me, and his troops come together to raise up against me. In verse 13, he hath put my brethren far from me, and my acquaintances are verily estranged from me. My kinsfolk have failed. My familiar friends have forgotten me. They that dwell in mine house, my maids, count me for a stranger. I'm alien in their sight. I called my servant, and he gave me no answer. I entreated him with my mouth. My breath is strange even to my wife, though I entreated for the children's sake of mine body. Yea, young children despise me. I arose, and they spake against me. All my inward friends abhorred me, and they whom I loved are turned against me. My bone cleaveth to my skin and to my flesh." He was skin and bones. "I'm escaped with the skin of my teeth. Have pity upon me, have pity upon me, O ye my friends, for the hand of God hath touched me. Why do you persecute me? Are you not satisfied with my flesh?" And then he stops. He says, "All right, now I want these next words that I'm going to speak. I want them remembered for every generation all over the world and way beyond the time of time and into eternity. I don't want anyone ever to forget these. These words, that they were written, I want them printed in a book. They were graven with an iron pen and let into the rock forever." This was the way the Oriental had of making sure that they were never lost, they would grave those words into rock, and then they'd pour lead in there, and the rock might wear away, but the lead would be remain. And Job said, I want these words leaded right into the rock. And these are the words. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skins worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God. My vindicator. I know that my vindicator liveth. The word that Job used in King James, it's Redeemer, and I don't know what your translation is, but it's an extremely important word. I know that my Redeemer liveth. It's Goel. It's the same word that's used to describe Boaz, the kinsman. Ruth's kinsman, or Naomi's kinsman, who made things right for Ruth and for Naomi. Job said, I know I have a kinsman, a blood relative. He hadn't seen Jesus Christ. I know that my kinsman liveth. And he says the same word is translated elsewhere, my vindicator, the one who vindicates every wrong. He makes right every wrong. He sets everything right. And furthermore, the same word goel is used to mean creator, or redeemer. My redeemer, the one who will buy back anything that may have been lost. You and I have seen Jesus Christ, the perfect one who suffered being perfect. Job had not seen him yet. And yet Job could say, I know that my Redeemer, Vindicator, blood relative, kinsman, liveth. Like a little girl that said, well, you find my daddy and he'll make things all right, my blood relative. And Job, out of all his misery, comes up to this particular point and everything has been thrown down at him this way. And he rises in the midst of that and he says, but I know that my Redeemer liveth. And of course, those words have echoed round the world and they still do. I know that my Redeemer liveth. I know that my Redeemer liveth. And they have been echoing in the hearts and lives of men and women ever since then. We see the path laid out by Jesus Christ through the trackless wilds of sorrow and discouragement and depression, through death and on into eternity. But Job hadn't seen that yet. And yet he could say, I know that my Redeemer liveth. How much easier is it for you and me to say that when the same things happen to us? How much easier it should be. And yet there are still many, even Christians, who do not stand the way Job did in the face of the same kinds of difficulties in your lives and our lives today. Well, this was the high point. This was the high point. Satan had done everything that he could to break this old man in every way, socially, physically, economically, and so domestically. He had done everything he could, but he couldn't. This isn't the end of it, though, because they go back to work on him even after he said this, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, and Job answers each one of them. You should, by all means, take up the study of these messages, these comfortings, and Job's responses to them, because it's the same general speech. Over in chapter 34, another man appears on the scene. His message is a little bit better than the message of Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. It's the message of Elihu, or Elihu. And he's a man who's closer to God, apparently, than Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar is. I wish we had time to go in and analyze his message. But in your own study of this book, you analyze Elihu's message. Take all the sayings of Elihu and see if you can crystallize them into one message and what he was trying to say to Job. It's a little bit better than what the other said, but not much different. He, too, is criticizing and even condemning poor old Job. But then it comes on over here a little bit further on to where in chapter 38, then the Lord answered Job out of a whirlwind. God stoops down at this point, and he picks up this poor old man who's so distraught and miserable, and he says to him over here, Job, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up thy loins now like a man, for I will demand of thee and answer thou me. A number of times through there, Job had said, I desire to reason with God. The word he uses is the same word that the Hebrew lawyers use. I desire to lay out my brief before God and reason my own case with him. And God uses this same word here. He says, gird up thy loins now like a man, for I will demand of thee and answer thou me. Job, before I can explain to you why it's necessary for all these things to have happened to you, I have to find out what your IQ is. I have to give you a little bit of a test. Now, here's some physical questions, and then we'll get on to the spiritual points a little bit later on. Job, first of all, in verse 4 there, where were you the day we laid the foundations of the earth? Were you in existence then? Do you know when that was? The day we laid the foundations to the earth. Declare if thou hast understand. Job, do you know how we laid the measures for the foundation? I want to talk on this for a little bit. Because he has lectured many times out of these passages, showing that many of the great research grants being given to our colleges and universities across the nation today are directly involved with answering the question that God asked Job. This is an interesting point. Because insofar as the grammar is concerned, in the Hebrew words, this is the oldest book in the Bible. How did the man that wrote this thing know to ask these questions? We're just getting around to asking them now in the laboratory. Verse 19, Job, where is the way where light dwelleth? Very interesting Hebrew word for way. The way where light dwelleth. A ray, it's an active thing. The way or ray where light dwelleth. And for darkness, where is the place thereof? Darkness is the absence of light, isn't it? I have a friend who's doing research for the Navy in black light. It's a layman's term for it in Washington and Indianapolis. This idea that we put a certain kind of light on a rifle, supposedly rifle or something, and we can see, but they can't see. It's a kind of light. But the darkness is something more than just the absence of light. And that there's a very interesting Hebrew phrase here having to do with the place for darkness and the ray for light. These are the Hebrew words that are very productive insofar as the scientist who will take the time to study the grammar is concerned. I had a friend who was head of the Department of Chemical Engineering at Ohio State University. You can find his name and write up in Who's Who, Dr. James R. Withrow. He's a close friend of General Pershing's in World War I. He's been dead for 2 or 3 years now. But he made this statement over and over again, that the young man or woman who would continue studying this book throughout college and high school and college and life would double his accomplishments in whatever field of work he chose to go into. Didn't say double his ability, said he would double his accomplishments insofar as his professional accomplishments were concerned. And he went on to illustrate that with many, many people. One of them, and he said he also had a graduate degree in geology, and he had done research all over the world for some of the major oil companies. And you'd say, well, certainly not in this cutthroat game, speculating for oil for some of the great oil companies. But one of his graduate students who was doing research in the Near East and reading his Bible, as Withrow had challenged him to do, remembered how it was that they had made the basket in which the baby had been put. Moses was the baby. And pitched it. I mean, threw it. I mean, they put something on the outside to keep it from sinking and made a boat out of it. And became interested in this terminology. A coal tar derivative. And they had done some research. And they had found some more.
in that area. He used many other instances along these same lines. The Firestone brothers, in connection with their work, he had many fascinating instances of this. The man and the woman who will keep on studying this book. And these are only a few of the examples through here of the questions that God was asking Job about the physical laws of the physical universe. And God saying, in effect, Job, if you can answer these, then I can go on to explain this to you, something of the infinitely more complex reasons for this physical and spiritual suffering that you're doing, the spiritual reasons for this physical suffering. But Job wasn't able to answer those questions. He still hadn't answered them, not all of them. We were working at them. And finally, I wish we had time to look at some more of these down through here. They have to do with the animal kingdom as well as some of these other physical phenomena. Then Job answered the Lord, chapter 42, last chapter of the book. Job answered the Lord and he said, I know that thou canst do everything, God, and that no thought can be withholden from thee. Who is he that hideth counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that I understood not things too wonderful for me which I knew not. And then God speaks again. Hear, I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. I have heard of thee, Job says, by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself, and I repent in dust and ashes. By his word abhor there, Job does not say that I have done moral sin. He has said, I am limited. I cannot understand. I cannot grasp God. Jerome Hines told us about how when he was a graduate student in science, he has graduate degrees in science before he went into music, and he told us how about how as a graduate student in I think it was physics, he had set himself to make a definition of God. And he had done it. Definition of God. He defined God. Studied the Bible, so he defined God. And then he was happy he could. But he said he became very unhappy because it was as though he was looking down upon God. He understood God. He was very unhappy with this. He realized that he hadn't really begun to comprehend God, so he scrapped that and began looking up to understand what he could of God. Job, it would seem, had desired to reason with God on an eye-to-eye basis as though he could understand everything that God had to do or say to him. But then he began to see that he could not understand all the reasons for this. Of course, you and I can. And I can point you to hundreds of men and women today who, in connection with their own suffering in hospitals and other places, have found intense help at the most critical moments in life on the verge of death through this book. As they look forward, as they look at the life of Jesus Christ, the one who was perfect, having done no sin, and yet the one who suffered. As they look through the eyes of Christ as Christians at the meaning of this book, they have found intense help over and over again. Now, Job, of course, couldn't see all these people and couldn't understand how this test was being accomplished in his life, how he was standing firm in the face of all the temptations and trials that Satan could draw upon him. It wasn't his prosperity that kept him close to God. It was his sheer love for God. And when everything else was gone and every effort was being made to beat and batter and bend him into the dust, he still stood because of his love for God. This stood strong and sure all the way through. And he says, I can't understand all the reasons for it, but I still can. I think of old Thayil McCulloch. His son, you know, was killed down there. Thayil died not very long ago. And he told us about this. He told us about how he and Mrs. McCulloch had loved that boy and they had followed him through life and how proud he was of that boy when he won that oratorical contest and how proud he was and thankful when that boy gave his life and went on down there to bring the gospel of good news to those people in Ecuador. And then it seemed as though the boy was taken and it was the night in which they were waiting for the news and the telephone call came and his boy's body had been identified. And he and Mrs. McCulloch had gone into the bedroom, and he said they wanted privacy, but just about that time the United Press called, and they said, do you have any statement?
He said he started to hang up the telephone and say no. And then he suddenly said, well, wait a minute. He said, I know that my Lord would not make any mistake. It seems to me this is the same thing Job is saying here. I don't understand all of it. I can't fathom all the reason for this. But I know that my Lord won't make any mistake. In verse 7 of that 42nd chapter, it was so that after the Lord had spoken these words unto Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, Eliphaz, my wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends. Ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right. Now that's their argument, you see. A man sins, he must have suffered. If he suffers, he must have sinned. I hope no one here ever makes that mistake. You look at a man who's suffering and say, you must have sinned because of that. I hope you never make that mistake. Not after seeing the way poor old Job suffered. And God says here, Eliphaz, you're wrong. You're wrong. The man who suffers has not necessarily sinned. You have not spoken of me the thing that is right as my servant Job hath. Therefore, take unto you now 7 bullocks and 7 rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering. And if my servant Job shall pray for you, him will I accept, lest I deal with you after your folly, in that ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right, like my servant Job hath. So Eliphaz the Temanite, and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite went and did according as the Lord commanded them. The Lord accepted Job. Job prayed for these miserable comforters of his. And the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. Also the Lord gave Job, you read the rest of the place. The Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came there unto him all his brethren, all his sisters, all they that had been of his acquaintance before. And they did eat bread with him in his house. They bemoaned him and comforted him over all the evil the Lord had brought upon him. Every man gave him a piece of money, and every one an earring of gold. See, a man's on his way up. Everybody wants to give him something. He's on his way down. Nobody's around. So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, 1,000 she-ass. All right. Some of you remember the numbers. Check them, will you? Somebody check them there. How many sheep did he have in the first chapter? How many sheep did he have in the last chapter? How many camels in the first chapter? And in the last chapter? How many yoke of oxen in the first chapter? And how many in the last chapter? How many she-asses in the first chapter? And how many in the last chapter? He had also 7 sons and 3 daughters. How many sons and daughters did he have in the first chapter? I thought God was going to double it. Bible's wrong. Made a mistake. God didn't keep his word. God promised to double his inheritance, give him twice as much as he had before. Have to give him 14 sons and 6 daughters. You know, the commentators have been pointing to this as a mistake in the Bible for years and years. And those others have been even challenging God that he didn't keep his word on. But Job had 14 sons and 6 daughters. 7 of those sons and 3 of those daughters were just as much alive as they'd ever been in heaven. And 7 of those sons and 3 of those daughters were with him on earth. The animals were not doubled in heaven. They had to be doubled on earth. But the 14 sons and the 6 daughters, just as much alive as they'd ever been. Satan did not take them in the sense of taking them away, really. They were just living in another place. We have a little girl who was taken from us, and so have some of you. We look forward to meeting her in heaven. Don't know very much what she was like. She was born then. But our children talk about meeting her someday. She's just as much alive as the others are. And many of you have other loved ones who will be just as much alive, and even more so. And Job called the name of the first Jemima, the name of the second Keziah, these are the daughters, the name of the third Karen Hapuk, and in all the land were no women found so fair as the daughters of Job. The Bible has something, they were good-looking gals. Bible, what a touching note. It's perfect. It's complete. In all the land were no women found so fair as the daughters of Job. And their father gave them inheritance among their brethren. And after this lived Job 140 years, and he saw his sons and his sons' sons even 4 generations. So Job died, being old and filled with days. Very interesting Hebrew phrase there. His cup of time was just filled to the brim. It didn't run over, so that he lasted on and on in misery. But his cup was filled full of days and of life right up to the very end. He was a man of life. He was a man who lived as we do.